So there's a lot of question marks, and I think that's really the problem. There's a lot of unknowns. The other outbreaks could be contained, but then they were also in the countryside in Argentina, and now we're on a cruise ship, right? And so, again, that makes it complicated. It's just the experience is lacking. We don't have the data.
Virological with Florian Kramer.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Virological. This was recorded on May 10th of 2026 in Vienna. And today we're going to talk about Andes virus. Before we start, I have to apologize. I have some kind of upper respiratory infection as well. So it might be a little bit harder to understand. I'm sure it's not Hunter virus. It's some kind of middle of the road respiratory virus that's going around. Okay, so I wanted to talk about Andes virus, and Andes virus is a Hunter virus. And so just going to start a little bit with some information about Hunter viruses. They're named after the Hunter An River in Korea. And during the Korean War, US soldiers became sick there with a disease that manifested as hemorrhagic fever with renal syndrome, so with also issues with the kidneys. And years later, the causative agent of that disease was identified, and that was what became Hunter virus. And so this virus there was Hunter An virus, and then this whole group of viruses, many of them were discovered later on, were called Hunter virus. And there's many of them. You find them globally, and most of them circulate in rodent populations, but they can also have other hosts like bats, for example. And some of them cause issues in humans. Typically, people get infected when they interact with rodents or with rodent droppings, rodent urine. And that's how you typically get infected with Hunter viruses. We'll get to that and what's going on right now as well, and why Andes virus is a very special Hunter virus. But typically, Hunter viruses cause infections through contact with rodents. Roughly, we have two types of Hunter viruses. We have the old world Hunter viruses that circulate in Asia, in rodents, and in Europe, and cause disease there in humans as well. And then we have the new world Hunter viruses, for example, Cinombre virus in the United States, but then also Andes virus in South America. Okay, so how does the virus look like? Andes virus has a single-stranded RNA genome with negative polarity. That's about, has coding capacity of about 12,000 base pairs, so about 12,000 letters. And it has a segmented genome. Similar to influenza, Andes virus, like all Hunter viruses, has three genomic segments, and they are called S, M, and L. So it's pretty simple. S is small, M is medium, and L is large. S encodes for the nucleoprotein, M encodes for the spike protein, which in this case is called GNGC. So G for glycoprotein, and then N for N-terminus, C for C-terminus. It's made as one protein and then cleaved into two parts. The GNGC protein is actually relatively complicated. It has three transmembrane domains. Its structure is complicated. The structure has become more clear. There's nice structural biology work on it, but there's still some open questions around it. And then the L segment encodes for the polymerase. And so the virus is relatively simple. We have an RNA genome on the inside, these three segments. The genome is covered, the RNA is covered by nucleoprotein. There's polymerase associated with it. Then we have a lipid envelope, and in this lipid envelope, we have the GNGC spike protein. The virion is about 80 to 160 nanometers in diameter, And for the New World Hunter viruses, so Zinombre in the United States, but also Andes, it is known that the receptor is protocatrin 1, which is protein on the cell surface. The virus docks onto the cells, and then it's taking up into an endosome. So these are these little vesicles that cells use to bring stuff inside. And then the pH in the endosome drops, becomes acidic, and that drop changes the structure of the glycoprotein. And the glycoprotein then fuses the viral membrane with the endosomal membrane. So there's a hole that forms, and through that hole, the genome can get released into the cell, into the cytoplasm, and then the virus starts to replicate there, replicate its genome, and then new virus particles are produced. Somebody put on Twitter that, you know, the virus goes to the nucleus. It doesn't do that. There are some RNA viruses that do that, but not Hunter viruses. Hunter viruses replicate in the cytoplasm. Okay, where can we find on this virus? It's circulating in rodents in mostly Chile and Argentina. The main host is Oligorhizomys longicaudatus. That's the long-tailed pygmy rice rat, which is a New World rat. And these animals are infected. They don't show any symptoms usually. They basically spread the virus amongst themselves. But they can also spread virus via their saliva, via urine, via feces. And then people can get in contact with these droppings. It's also possible that there's transmission via direct contact with these animals, via bites or scratches. But what very often happens is that, you know, there's droppings, the droppings dry out. Then through some activity, dust is developed. Could be, for example, somebody using a broom to clean up, and there are these droppings and they're dry, and that aerosolizes some of that material, and then people inhale that and then they become infected. This is actually true for many different Hunter viruses and also for Andes virus. Most cases are caused by contact to rodents or their droppings. We'll talk about human-to-human transmission a little bit later. Andes virus is the only known Hunter virus that can do that. But again, most cases acquire the infection through contact with these animals. The people who are most at risk for infections are people who spend a lot of time outdoors and in basically the habitat of these long-tailed pygmy rice rats. That includes hikers, people who go camping, farmers, forest workers, miners, military personnel, zoologists who work with these animals. And most infections actually happen in rural areas, which makes sense, right? Because that's where these animals are. Okay, so people get exposed. Then there's an incubation time that can last from 1 to 8 weeks. Typically, it's 1 to 6 weeks. And then there's a first phase of symptoms, first phase of disease that lasts 1 to 5 days. And that's influenza-like. People get fever, they're tired, they're lethargic, they get muscle aches, headache. And because Andes virus replicates in the respiratory tract as well, often there's respiratory symptoms, including shortness of breath. And then this moves into a second phase, and that's the cardiopulmonary phase. So there's two words there, cardio and pulmonary, right? So heart and lung. And so the virus starts to attack the lung, the heart, and that's, of course, problematic. One of the symptoms of that phase is that people have irregular and often very fast heart rate. People develop cardiogenic shock. So basically, the heart is not able anymore to pump enough blood. There's also pulmonary capillary leakage. So liquid builds up in the lungs. This can lead to respiratory failure, very low blood pressure, shock, basically. And the name for this syndrome is Hunter virus pulmonary syndrome, so HBS. And this is typically what New World Hunter versus do. Sinombre causes very similar symptoms. And this is in contrast to what the old world Hunter versus do, like Hantaan. They cause hemorrhagic fever with renal syndrome, so HFRS. So there you have involvement of the kidney. During this second phase, the infection very often leads to death, mortality rate or case fatality rate, actually, somewhere between 20-40%. And people who survive the infection usually also recover relatively slowly. It can take months until the lung function is really back. So not a nice disease to have. It's relatively dangerous. A little bit about the history. It was discovered in 1995 in outbreaks in Argentina and in the same year also in Chile. And because it happened in regions of the Andes Mountains, the virus was called Andes virus. It's also important to stress that it's not super homogeneous. There's different clades, different versions of the virus, and the genotypes might actually also play a role in how likely it is that one of these strains infects humans or jumps from human to human. I think we don't understand all of that. There's a lot of question marks with Andes virus, but there's genetic diversity. In 1996, there was an outbreak in the Rio Negro province of Argentina, and there there were first hints that the virus might jump from human to human. 2014, there were also clusters in Argentina that suggested human-to-human transmission. And then there was third incidence in 2018-2019 in Epuyén in the Chubut province, where there was an outbreak in this village, Epuyén, with 34 confirmed cases and 11 deaths. And there it's clearly investigated that this was a lot of human-to-human transmission. Actually, there were three people who were responsible for most of that outbreak, for most of the infections. And if one person infects a lot of people, that's called a super spreader. We know this from SARS-CoV-1. It was a big thing there. But Hunter viruses, or specifically Andes virus, might be able to do that as well. I think overall, the reproductive number in that outbreak, they are not, was about 2, which means one infected person infects on average 2 more people. And if you let that go, of course, the virus spreads, right? But countermeasures were implemented, and that outbreak in Epuyén was then efficiently stopped. And so, because we have so little experience, there's a lot of question marks about human-to-human transmission of Andes virus. There's some data that suggests that people need to be in the early phase of symptomatic disease in order to spread the virus to another person. But on the other side, it cannot be excluded that somebody who is in the incubation period and isn't symptomatic yet might also spread the virus. So there's question marks there. The assumption is also that you need relatively close contact to spread the virus, but that wasn't the case for all human-to-human transmissions that have been recorded either. And then in terms of mechanism, the assumption is that the virus can spread via respiratory droplets, but potentially also via saliva. The GI tract might be involved in some cases. And we also know that the virus can spread from mothers to babies. There's at least one case that I came across where it's not clear if it was through breast milk or already via the placenta, but that spread is possible too. So there's a lot of question marks, and I think that's really the problem. There's a lot of unknowns. There's not enough experience to really say now, okay, you know, this is not going to become a big outbreak, right? That's the assumption that everybody has. The other outbreaks could be contained, but then they were also in the countryside in Argentina, and now we're on a cruise ship, right? And so, again, that makes it complicated. It's just the experience is lacking. We don't have the data, and there are a lot of question marks. And while it seems like the situation is under control, and there might be some more cases popping up, but the assumption is that this will be handled and that the outbreak or that this incident will resolve in the next few weeks. We're not 100% sure, right? And with viruses, there's always surprises. So that's why we have to be careful with this. And that brings me to the actual situation on the with this cruise ship, right? This is the MV Hondius, and this cruise ship left Ushuaia. This is a city in Fireland, Tierra del Fuego in Argentina. They left there on April 1st. And April 6th, one person got sick on board. And it seems like this was a Dutch ornithologist who had already been traveling in South America for 4 months since end of last November. At least that's what I read in the news. And maybe I should say that before we get started here. I have to stress this is 10th of May at night. This is the current situation, and this is, in terms of information that I have, partially based on what the WHO said, partially based on what news outlet said. So the situation is a little bit chaotic. It's evolving. This episode is going to come out on Wednesday. Today is Sunday. So the situation might change. There might be more information that comes out. So keep that in mind with everything that I'm saying. Take it with a grain of salt. But anyways, this cruise ship left Argentina. And on April 6th, somebody got sick. As I said, there is now suggestions that this was a Dutch ornithologist who had already been traveling extensively in the region. And unfortunately, he passed away on April 11th. The cruise continued. They were out on the Atlantic. And from 13th to 15th of April, they stopped at Tristan da Cunha. So Tristan da Cunha is an island that belongs to the UK, but it's in the South Atlantic, and it doesn't even have an airport, so it's very remote. So keep that in mind. And then the cruise ship sailed on and reached St. Helena on April 24th. St. Helena is another island in the middle of the Atlantic. And the body of the deceased person was brought off the ship, and the wife of that first person who died also left the ship and was already symptomatic. 30 more patients, or maybe it was 29, maybe they counted her as well, left the ship at St. Helena and then departed by plane. So a lot of people left there. And then the ship sailed on. And on April 27th, they docked at Ascension, which is another island in the Atlantic. And another person on board was sick, and that person was evacuated to Johannesburg in South Africa and treated there in ICU. I believe the person is still there in that ICU. And I believe that was the first person that was tested positive for hantavirus. I might get it wrong, but I think that person was tested positive. And that's when the news broke that there's potentially a situation with hantavirus. On April 28th, another person became symptomatic, a person from Germany. And that person died on May 2nd. And I believe she was that body was still on the boat when they arrived in Tenerife. On May 4th, it was confirmed by the WHO that this virus is actually Andes virus. And this is important information, because there were other possibilities, right? If you just know the people, the infected individuals are positive for Hunter virus, it could also be, and that was what the earlier report was, it could also be, for example, a rodent infestation on the ship. If there are rats carry Sol hantavirus, which is actually an Asian hantavirus, and that could have caused some of these symptoms, but it turned out to be Andes virus. And that was crucial information, because Andes virus is capable of human-to-human transmission, right? While Sol virus cannot do that, at least it hasn't been reported at all. But yeah, on May 4th, we learned that this is indeed Andes virus. Then from May 3rd to May 6th, the cruise ship anchored in Cap Verde, and three more people were evacuated from the ship. I believe a person from the UK, I think that was the physician of the ship. He had become sick. He was evacuated to the Netherlands. I believe there was also another person from the Netherlands that was evacuated. They had some issues with that plane. I think they had to change planes in Gran Canaria, but that person was also flown to the Netherlands. And then also a person from Germany who was finally evacuated to Germany, to Düsseldorf. And there was some more news that broke on May 6th. In the meantime, somebody had become symptomatic in Switzerland, and it was one of the people who left the ship on St. Helena, one of these 30 people. And hantavirus infection was actually confirmed in that person. The person is in a hospital in Switzerland. I believe his wife was also with him on the ship, and the latest I heard was that she didn't have any symptoms, but that she was self-quarantining in Switzerland. Okay, and then May 6th, Hondius left Cape Verde, but before they left, three or four medical professionals boarded the ship. There's conflicting reports about that, and they came on board to help with the medical situation, but this also included two epidemiologists to kind of find, who were there to find out what actually happened and to figure out how a transmission could have worked. Just to basically get more information. On May 8th, the sequence from the Swiss patient was released online, so the Swiss were working very, very quickly. And again, we already knew it was Andes virus, but now there's a sequence and you can actually look where that sequence falls within these different Andes virus clades. And yeah, it's closely related to what you would expect in this area. But super nice job and super quick work by the investigators in Switzerland. Okay, initially I said that the ship stopped at Tristan da Cunha, and today, so May 10th, there was news that there might be one person on Tristan da Cunha who is symptomatic. The problem is that they don't have a lot in terms of medical facilities. They don't have an airport, and it takes a long time to go there by ship. And so they needed medical supplies and medical personnel. And since people from the UK couldn't just go there and land there and help, they actually sent the 16th Assault Brigade, and they flew over Tristan da Cunha and then parachuted down with medical personnel and about 3,000 kilograms of medical equipment, including oxygen, to support treatment of that person. I don't think there's a lot of details about the symptoms and how this person is doing, but potentially this person was infected during interaction with people from that ship when it anchored there and visited. Okay, and so we still have to go back to these 30 people that left the cruise ship in St. Helena. It seems they're all accounted for, so contact tracing was done. Maybe I should mention this, the WHO is, of course, coordinating a lot of these efforts. There's a lot of energy put into finding all these contacts, making sure that they are accounted for, that it's clear if they have symptoms or not, that they can be quarantined if they become symptomatic, and so on and so forth. This is done basically in coordination between the WHO and all the countries that are involved and their national agencies, their national public health agencies. And it's actually nice to see how efficient that is. So for this first 30, as far as I know, everybody's accounted for. Yeah, and one of the people who left cruise ship in St. Helena was, of course, the wife of the first case. And she also took a flight from St. Helena to Johannesburg and then wanted to go from there to the Netherlands via KLM flight 592. But she was already symptomatic when she left the cruise ship, and her health deteriorated relatively quickly. So she boarded that flight, that KLM flight to Amsterdam from Johannesburg, but then had to deboard again because of her health. And unfortunately, she also died in South Africa. But during that time on board, which was relatively short, KLM flight attendant took care of her. So this flight attendant then also became symptomatic, but the good news is that the person tested negative for hantavirus. And so today, the Hondius arrived in Granadilla and Tenerife with 147 individuals on board. And as far as I have seen on the news today, different nations started evacuation flights to bring their nationals home, likely into quarantine, into medical monitoring, which would make sense. And again, the situation is still under control, and that we might hear about a few more cases in the next few days, but then it will hopefully calm down, and hopefully that outbreak will end relatively soon. People are getting nervous about this a little bit, and this is because of these open questions, right? The unclarity about human-to-human transmission, and then in addition, this setting on a cruise ship. And in addition to that, there's also issues because we don't have any therapeutics to treat people with hantavirus infections. There's basically not much you can do. You can just treat the symptoms, right? There are some suggestions that ribavirin might be helpful, but that might also not be very effective, and that data is not very hard. And so we don't have any antivirals, any specific treatment that we can give, right? And that's tough, right? Because there's not much you can do. Historically, for Hanta-An, plasma therapy was used. But again, there's no hard data that suggests that it worked well. So plasma therapy basically means that people who survived the infection were donating their plasma with neutralizing antibodies in it, and then you would use that to treat fresh cases. That was done back in the day for Hanta-An infections during the Korean War. But again, we don't know if that would work, and it would also be hard to find enough people who had historically Hantavirus infections. I missed to mention that initially, but there's about 100 to 200 Hantavirus infections in Chile and Argentina every year. And I think this is also a good kind of comparison of how problematic this is in terms of human-to-human transmission. There's this described cases where human-to-human transmission happened, right? Relatively few. But then there's a sizable amount, not a lot, but a sizable amount of infections every year. And most of them are just zoonotic infections where people get this virus from a rodent and then don't give it to another human, right? So I think we have to keep that in mind also if we think about the situation. But still, there's so many unknowns, and that makes people uneasy. And then again, we don't have any therapeutics, right? And then the other point that makes me a little bit uneasy is vaccine development for hantaviruses might not be so straightforward. There's one type of vaccine that is available for hantaviruses, and that's against Hanta-An virus that's produced in Korea and China. And that's an inactivated vaccine where you grow the virus in cell culture and then harvest and purify it and inactivate it. But the vaccine doesn't work very well. And one of the reasons potentially why this is the case is because the virus doesn't grow very well in cell culture. It's really hard to cultivate it. And so you don't get enough yields during the vaccine production process. And so it might be really hard to make an inactivated vaccine for this virus. In addition to that, it would be really hard to grow this virus in, you know, biosafety level 3 or 4 conditions, probably biosafety level 4 because of the large volumes needed to make a vaccine, right? How do you do that technically? Even if you do it at biosafety level 3, there's not that many facilities that can handle that, right? If you can grow enough of the virus, if it doesn't grow well enough. In addition to that, it might be hard to make recombinant protein vaccines just because this GNGC spike is so complex. We now have a good idea about the structure, how it looks like, but there's open questions there too. It's not so easy to make it a soluble recombinant glycoprotein. And so it might not be possible to do that, right? There have been DNA vaccines against hantaviruses that have been developed, including against Andes, but they're in early clinical stage, and it's not clear if you could roll that out for hundreds of millions of people. And it's also not clear if it would work, right? Because this glycoprotein, even if you use it as DNA vaccine, it's hard to express. It's hard for our cells to make a lot of it. And mRNA vaccines would potentially be one of the things that could work, but even there, we don't know if they do work, right? They've been tested in animal models, but as far as I know, there's no human data for Andes virus mRNA vaccine. So there's a lot of question marks. There's a lot of research missing into hantaviruses. It's also one of the few viruses where we don't have a reverse genetic system, right? That would allow us to manipulate the virus to kind of get a better understanding of certain molecular functions. So again, what I'm trying to stress here is that there's a situation and it's under control, and it's very likely that this is not going to be a big issue in the long run. There could be a few more cases, but on the other side, but it's probably staying under control. On the other side, there's these open questions, right? There's these things that we just don't know. And there's this research that's missing. And I think if we learn something from this outbreak is that we have to take this virus serious, and we probably have to take hantaviruses in general serious, and probably should focus a little bit more on doing research on them. And that's it for today for Virological. As always, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, just write an email at virological@podcastwerkstatt.com. And if you want to support the podcast, you can do that on Steady. Just one more note. I'm probably going to do one more episode to follow up on the situation, probably in 2 weeks. If it calms down, if it doesn't calm down, if other things happen, I might record something earlier. But again, I think the assumption that people have is that it is under control, and that with all this effort put into contact tracing and isolation quarantine measures, this should not become a big problem. Thanks for listening, and until next time.
If you're enjoying the podcast and would like to support our work, visit us on Steady. You'll find the link in the show notes. And don't forget to follow and leave a review on your favorite podcast app. Podcast-Werkstatt.